Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. I am Bob Inyart, the pastor of Denver Bible Church. Well, by now, this is the fourth show in the series. I hope he's also your favorite scientist. I know he's mine. Dr. Walt Brown wrote the best-selling book, In the Beginning, on creation and the global flood. He received a PhD from MIT, taught science at the Air Force Academy. Walt, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Bob.
The flood. People have asked, where did the water come from? Well, we know that it came, as the Bible says, from the fountains of the great deep, from under the crust of the earth.
Right.
But here's a follow-up question. Where did it go?
Okay, it's a good question. It'll take a couple minutes here to explain it, but picture the water of the flood covering the entire earth.
Mm-hmm.
The lower mountains that were on the pre-flood earth were completely covered. We talked a couple days ago about the mid-oceanic ridge rising, especially beginning in the Atlantic. The ridge rises in the Atlantic, causing the continental plates, which are called hydroplates, to slide away from the rising mid-Atlantic ridge.
They're hydroplates because they're on water.
They're on water.
The original creation of the earth.
Right. And so the hydroplates are now sliding away from this rising mid-Atlantic ridge and the rising chamber floor. Chamber floor is down about 10 miles before the flood, the subterranean water chamber floor. So as the chamber floor is rising and the mid-oceanic ridge is bulging up, these continents are sliding downhill on a lubricating layer of water.
Hmm.
They're picking up speed. They're accelerating. Probably reach 40 to 50 miles per hour. So picture a continental hydroplate the size of the Americas, north, south, and central America.
Sliding to the west.
Sliding to the west. And Europe and Africa and Asia sliding to the east, going 40, 45, maybe 50 miles per hour. What's going to happen when that lubricant underneath the sliding plates is depleted or when the plates run into a resistance?
Then the friction is going to stop the slide of the continents.
Picture a train running away downhill, accelerating downhill. Eventually, that train's going to crash. You don't know where. But it'll crash, and then what's going to happen? Those boxcars are going to jackknife.
Right. It will buckle up.
That's right.
The continent, which is about, say, 3,000 miles wide, this continent, as it's sliding to the west, it'll meet resistance, friction, and it'll start to buckle up. And it buckled at the Rocky Mountains and also at the Appalachians.
That's right.
And they run north-south, these buckled mountain ranges.
As you would expect. Roughly parallel to the mid-Atlantic Ridge. It's a little bit like an avalanche in your snow country there. The sheet of snow starting to slide down, picking up speed, and then eventually meets more resistance as the slope maybe levels out, and you get lots of little mountains forming. Well, the tremendous momentum of these continents, these hydroplates, roughly 10 miles thick, is enough to compress, crush, thicken, and buckle hydroplates. They're thickening. So as they thicken, what's going to happen? They're going to rise out of the floodwaters.
Okay.
Now, have to understand, there's a lot of water on the earth today, on the surface of the earth today. There is more water in our oceans than there is land above sea level by a factor of 10. 10 times more water in our oceans by volume.
Wow.
Than there is land above sea level. So the thickened continents don't have to rise very much to give us our 30% land, 70% water.
Okay.
The earth. So that's where the water went. In other words, it went into the very deep ocean basins.
Mm-hmm.
They were very deep, especially after the flood, because the chamber floor was down about 10 miles.
So as Europe, Asia, and Africa slid to the east, and North and South America slid to the west, they then stopped and buckled and rose up, and so the water drained off the continents into the ocean basins.
And they thickened.
They
crushed
thickened.
And thickened, and it's that compression that formed, that lifted up mountains.
And so most of the major mountain ranges in the world seem to be north-south. Like, the Rockies go basically from the Canadian Rockies right down into South America.
Right. It appears other factors going on there, but that's first approximation. That's true, yes.
Right. There are other details, but it appears that it was the same event that formed that massive, long mountain range.
And so the major mountains of the Earth formed in hours. Mm. Picture that. Imagine the sounds that you would have heard. Mm. You might go to 104th Psalm, 6th through the 9th verse. The water was covering all the mountains. I'm paraphrasing here. The mountains rose, the valleys sank down. At the sound of thy thunder, the water ran away. It's talking about the event I just described.
Yeah, that's right.
The sound of the thunder. My goodness.
Wow. Then the Bible says after Noah's flood, back early in Genesis, it says that the earth was divided in Peleg's day. And this is a guy who lived a few generations after, there were longer generations back then, but after Noah's flood. And so what would that mean, that the earth was divided? That word earth, it's talking about the land.
Right. The word division, the Hebrew word for division, contains the P-E-L symbol.
Of Peleg.
Of Peleg, right. And our language today has that in it, archipelago, pelagic sediments.
Islands that are divided by water,
the
chain of islands.
Of the word for Peleg mean a division by water. Hmm. Not a division by languages, not a division of the earth by continental dividing.
Right.
And those are the two explanations the commentaries will talk about.
Mm-hmm.
No, it's a division by water. And I can list you dozens of words in Hebrew that contain those symbols. They all convey the idea of division by water.
Mm-hmm.
So, remember I said how deep this pre-flood chamber floor was?
Yes.
And how deep the oceans were immediately after the flood. So, that's where the water went as the continents were crushed and thickened. So, the continents are now thick, heavier, and the ocean floors don't have any big masses resting on it. And they're deeper. It's been known for 50 years that underneath the continent sinks into the mantle, whereas under the oceans, the mantle sticks up. So what's going to happen? The continents have to sink in.
The continents gradually begin to sink.
Sink into the mantle, and in compensation for that downward movement of mass, you've got to have an upward movement of whatever is lighter, and that would be the chamber floor, the ocean. So
sea level gradually rose as the continents settled into the post-flood crust.
And that's what surprises people, Bob, is they think, well, here's the flood, covered all the earth. They don't have any idea where all that water could come from.
Mm.
And then they're doubly puzzled by where could it have gone afterwards.
Right.
And to say that sea level was lower after the flood is not something they would have anticipated.
Right.
Unless they get into the look at the forces, the energy, and the mechanisms of this whole process.
And what's fascinating is that the hydroplate theory, based on one assumption of how the pre-flood Earth had been created, all these observations flow logically.
That's right.
It's not like you have to solve each dilemma with a different theory. It's all based on one theory, on one assumption of the subterranean chamber, the sphere of water under the crust of the Earth.
That's right. The one assumption is that there was a lot of water under the crust of the Earth, and believe it or not, yes, in a scientific sense, we have to say it's an assumption, but the Bible speaks of it.
It sure does.
Many places.
And so now we have even secular scientists talk about the continents having at one time been connected with land bridges.
Yes.
And those land bridges were covered up because the continents had thickened and were raised up out of the water. Then they began to settle in the centuries after the flood. And eventually the land bridges that connected the continents were covered, and that's why the earth was divided. People could no longer migrate over those land bridges. They had to build ships.
Yes. All you need to do, Bob, is lower sea level today by about 300 feet, and you will interconnect all continents of the earth.
Wow.
The Bering Strait from Asia to North America becomes connected.
Wow.
Australia becomes connected to Southern Asia.
And so when Genesis states, it strongly implies that God made one landmass and then the sea.
That's right. There were a lot of seas before the flood. But the oceans we have today are unique to after the flood.
Right. There was one landmass, Pangaea. Well, geologists today are figuring that out, in that the Earth was once, even after the flood, connected, and then it was divided. Those land bridges were flooded by the rise in seawater. The Bible points to that also.
Yes. After the flood, sea level was about almost 3 miles lower than it is today. And then it slowly rose over the centuries. Peleg was living about 200 to 300 years after the flood. There are five generations between he and Noah. And so in Peleg's day, either the people that named him, his parents, or himself, he was probably an explorer, or his parents were explorers, they realized that the earth was becoming divided by rising sea levels, rising water, coming from maybe 15,000 feet below sea level today, almost 3 miles, up to approaching today's level. And as it rose, it would drown these land bridges.
Hmm. Dr. Brown, this brings us really logically to the issue of the Ice Age, because how you were describing first that right after the flood, the continents, they slid, North and South America to the west, and then the compression event, they stopped sliding and they thickened and they were pushed up out of the water. The problem with the Ice Age that secular scientists struggle with is that you need a warm earth to get all the precipitation, yet you need cold continents. And they have a very hard time in their models, in their computer simulations, trying to get an ice age to start. How does the hydroplate theory answer that?
Well, as you say, there are a couple of requirements for an ice age. You have to have warm oceans in order to get the evaporation, in order to get the precipitation, which in the colder latitudes, climates, high altitudes, so forth, is snow. And it's the snow that packs down, soaks, and becomes glaciers. And we have a lot of water trapped in glaciers on the Earth. Roughly 200 times more water is locked into ice, primarily in Antarctica and Greenland, as is in our lakes.
Hmm.
So a lot of ice on the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
So you need the warm oceans in order to have that. I just explained, although I didn't go into details, how you get the warm oceans. The hydroplates are sliding away from the Mid-Atlantic Ridge.
Mm-hmm.
They crush, thicken. The floor of the chamber in the Atlantic region rises to become the Atlantic floor.
Mm-hmm.
And that rising must be compensated by material from the opposite side of the Earth moving in the direction of the Atlantic floor. When the floor of the Atlantic Ocean rises, something's got to take its place underneath.
So in the Pacific, you have the subduction of the trenches and the Pacific.
Well, there's no subduction. There is movement of the Pacific floor is being pulled down.
Oh, that's a plate tectonics term.
Yeah, the plate tectonics says subduction is occurring. I have in the book 15 reasons why subduction cannot occur.
Hmm.
When you read that, you say, how could anyone have ever believed this?
I remember that fascinating section, and so I just used that word incorrectly.
I have a table that lists the 15 reasons and then links or page numbers to where I describe why subduction cannot go on.
Right.
But the plate tectonic theory doesn't work for lots of reasons, one of which is they assume subduction is going on, but
okay.
Subduction can't happen. So you're getting a lot of friction inside the Earth, and that is melting the inner part of the Earth, and that's why the outer core of the Earth is a liquid.
Hmm.
And as the Pacific floor is pulled down, there's a lot of cracking, a lot of that molten material from the outer core is coming up and into the Pacific. So now you're getting a warm Pacific. Today we speak of El Niños. What's an El Niño? It's the warming of the Pacific in a certain year,
right.
In a year, and it causes weather pattern changes that affect a lot of us where we live.
Mm-hmm.
But what causes the warming in the Pacific? I think it's magma coming up from inside the Earth and warming the Pacific and forming these volcanoes. There are about 40,000 volcanoes on the floor of the Western Pacific.
Mm.
So you've got the warm oceans now, right after the flood.
So after the flood, the oceans are warm.
Yeah, but you need it to be cold as well,
and
those seem like contradictory requirements. How high is it cold? Remember, the continents were higher after the flood, thousands of feet higher, because they were crushed, thickened, and rose up out of the flood waters. Now they've got to sink in, and in compensation for that downward movement of mass into the mantle is going to rise where there's less resistance above it, namely in the ocean floor. So the ocean floors are going to rise over the centuries. The continents are going to sink in, And geologists have known for 40, 50, 60 years that underneath the continents have sunk into the mantle. And especially mountain ranges, the roots of mountains, that's what they're called, roots. Some of them go down 70 miles, whereas the continents are typically 30 miles thick, maybe 60 miles at the most. So everything is sinking in under continents. Things are rising on the ocean floor. So while the continents are high, they are cold. Climb a mountain, and you realize the higher you go up into the atmosphere, the colder it gets.
Yeah, Leadville, Colorado, I think that town is about 10,000 feet elevation. You go there in the summer, and it's cold.
Yeah, for every 1,000 feet you climb in a mountain, the temperature drops about 3 degrees Fahrenheit.
Okay.
So you got the cold conditions on the continents. You got the warm conditions in the ocean. They're not contradictory. They're going to produce lots of snowfall and accumulation of snow, and there are your ice ages.
And so there's more than a million square miles, I'm just estimating, around the Earth covered with ice and snow on the continents, which today that's now melted because the surface of the Earth began to slowly stabilize in the centuries after the flood.
That's right.
Okay. All right. I understand where the water came from, where it went, how the major mountain ranges were formed rapidly, how the Earth was divided in Peleg's day, and what the origin of the Ice Age was and why it all then melted away. Now, could we go outside of the Earth? I'd like to ask you about the moon.
Okay.
Because Big Bang scientists and atheists, they want us to believe that they've figured out how the entire universe and all the galaxies were formed. They have the most difficult time with the moon. Dr. Brown, are you aware, why do they struggle with the formation of the moon? It's just the moon.
Well, there are four theories that have been put out for the origin of the moon. Three of them were being beaten around for about 100 years. In fact, Darwin's son helped propose one of them. They have been so demolished that the subject was kind of embarrassing. Let's deal with those three first. One is that the moon spun off of the Earth. The Earth was spinning very fast, supposedly, as it was evolving, and a chunk of it spun off, and that became the moon. Well, the physics of that just don't work to form a moon. If something was spinning so fast that a chunk flew off of it, it would do one of two things. It would fly up in the air away from the Earth, and then it would fall straight back down, or it would be spinning so fast it would fly and escape the gravity of the Earth. It would not end up in an orbit tangentially around the Earth. So just simple junior high physics kills that thing.
Okay.
Another is that the early solar system was a spinning dust cloud. The sun formed in the center of it, and then the planets kind of congealed from this material, and around them there were dust clouds, and they congealed to form the moons. Well, all sorts of problems with that. First of all, dust clouds don't clump into planets and so forth. Just look at Saturn's rings. Saturn's rings are not clumping. They're going the other way. They're spreading out. By the way, Saturn's rings were used as an example of what they thought the early solar system and early planets looked like until they realized those rings can't last more than a few thousand years.
They're changing tremendously even as we watch them.
That's right.
And if they're billions of years old, they should have come to a stasis.
And a few years ago, a spacecraft photographed rings being formed. And what happens is there are very small moons around Saturn and Jupiter and Neptune. And they get clobbered with asteroids and comets, and they kick up a cloud of dust. And because the little moons are so small, their gravity can't hold on to that dust, and that dust ends up going in an orbit around Saturn, Neptune, or Jupiter. And so the rings are forming today, have nothing to do with the origin of the planets. But you don't see the rings of Saturn starting to form into small moons. It's going the other way. The moons are fragmenting and being pulverized and forming the rings.
All right.
So that was another theory that has bitten the dust, and every astronomer who's worth his salt understands that. A third explanation was that the moon was captured.
Yeah. It was floating along, and the gravity of the Earth captured it.
Captured it. Well, orbital mechanics says that doesn't happen. Or if it does happen, it is extremely rare. And let's just simplify this. If you have two bodies, one being the Earth and another body coming in near the Earth, see if it becomes a moon, it will either collide with the Earth or it will swing around the Earth and fly away about as fast as it came in. And it doesn't end up getting captured into an orbit around the Earth.
If something was captured, it would have such an elongated orbit. It wouldn't be this nearly circular orbit that our moon has.
Right. And so those are the three ideas that have been kind of an embarrassment for the last 30 years as scientists have realized what the scientific problems are. And there are many more that I haven't touched on here that we don't have time for. Well, what's the fourth one? Well, there was a big conference out in Hawaii about 20 years ago, and they resurrected this whole problem and said, you know, we've got to do better than what we've done in the past. And they came up with what's called the impact theory. And the big splash is another name for it. What they're saying there is that a body about the size of Mars came in near the Earth, and it collided, a glancing blow. And that threw out into space a lot of debris, and the glancing blow slowed down this Mars-size impactor, so it could go into orbit around the Earth. And the debris then collected around this Mars-size impactor, and we have the moon. Well, a lot of problems with that. If that had happened, we should see a lot of debris still in orbit around the Earth, other than just the moon, and it's not there.
Right.
If a Mars-sized impactor clipped the Earth, you would have the Earth either spinning too fast now or other dynamical problems that have no solution. So that problem is kind of an embarrassment.
Nature, the journal Nature, which is probably the premier Big Bang/evolution publication in the world, back in 1997 had this quote, and they meant it as a joke, but they were talking about the difficulty of explaining how the moon got there, and they said the best explanation for the moon is observational error. The moon doesn't exist.
Right.
And that's because they can't explain the moon, and God put it there to give us light at night and for the tides of the oceans, the life-giving tides. They oxygenate the oceans. It gives us a beautiful eclipse of the sun that helps us understand how the sun functions in our solar system and the galaxy. It's just a beautiful creation of God.
Yeah, and what an evolutionist has to say, and what they do say, is, well, it's rare that something like the big splash could occur and a moon could form, and we're going to forget about the dynamical problems with that, but it could have happened. And then I just have to say, well, okay, but there are 155 other moons that are known in the solar system.
Let's
go to the second one.
That's beautiful.
Let's see if
okay.
We can...
Dr. Walt Brown, the last question for the week.
Okay.
Before God created the sun on the fourth day of Genesis 1, there was light. He said, let there be light, and there was evening and morning the first, second, third days. What was the light? What do you think was the light before God made the sun?
Well, you don't need to have the sun to have light. What is light? Light is an electromagnetic phenomenon. Whenever an electron goes from a higher energy state, some like to think of it as a higher orbit, to a lower one, it gives off a photon of light. And so there could very well have been, after matter was created, and as the electronic structure of matter was starting to form, as electrons were falling into their particular orbits or positions around the nuclei of atoms, it would have given a burst of light. There would have been a burst of light just associated with the creation.
So that God made the heavens and the earth, and the matter that he created for the universe, including all that matter for the Milky Way galaxy, that matter would emit a flash of light that would travel through the created space at that time.
And we would still be seeing that light, at least the light that's coming from the furthest distances.
Mm-hmm.
So there would have been a flash of light as matter near the earth was giving off its light and falling, but there would also be light coming right behind it from further distances. And you know what? They've found that light. And it's called the cosmic background radiation.
CMB.
That's right.
Cosmic microwave background radiation.
Right. It has all sorts of characteristics, physical characteristics, that indicate that that's what happened.
And so then the matter that God created for the Milky Way, that matter would have also created a flash of light. And that light, since the Earth is on the edge of the Milky Way galaxy, we're not in the middle of it, we're toward an outer edge of it, So the side from the Earth facing the Milky Way, that would have lit up that side of the Earth.
Right. There was light at the end of day one.
Mm-hmm.
And there were evenings and mornings
okay.
ever since. But the sun wasn't created until day four, so there's a source of light somewhere.
Yes.
And I think the very most likely explanation is what I've given you.
All right. Dr. Walt Brown, thank you so much for joining us this week.
I enjoyed being with you this week, Bob.
May God bless you and your family, your wife Peggy, and your ministry, creationscience.com. What a website. Thank you, Dr. Brown.
Thank you, Bob. Bye.
God bless you. For our first-time listeners, if you've never called or ordered anything from Bob and Yurt Live, give us a ring and we will give you a gift, our Age of the Earth debate on CD. You'll love it. It's 1-800-836-9278, 800-836-9278. And for the rest of you, Walt Brown's bestseller. The book is In the Beginning. You can get it from us at Bob and Yurt Live by our website, kgov.com. Or calling us at 800-836-9278, 800-836-9278. It's an autographed copy by Dr. Walt Brown and Maranatha Christian Center in Arvada, Colorado. What a great school, Maranatha. May God bless you. It's January and a new year. We can help you make some great New Year's resolutions. I'd like to grow more this year in my knowledge of Scripture. I'd like to be more well prepared to talk to others about eternity. I'd like to become more mature as a believer. Would it please you to achieve these goals this year? If so, please consider letting us help you. At Bob and Yurt Live, we've assembled really great teaching resources for you to grow in your Bible knowledge and to grow as a Christian and to develop personally. I'd like to recommend a subscription to one of our monthly resources. If you subscribe during this month of January, as a gift, right away, we'll send you an extra month's fulfillment. If you subscribe to our monthly Bible study albums, we'll send you two albums for the first month to get you on your way. If you subscribe to our monthly sermons, we'll send you 2 months' worth of sermons. If you subscribe to our monthly videos, we'll send you an extra DVD. Either call us or subscribe online. You can call us at 800-8-N-YARD. That's 800-836-9278. 836-9278. Or go online to kgov.com. That's kgov.com. Just click on the store and then subscriptions. You can be more prepared to influence others for good, including your own family, coworkers, and friends. If you let us help you achieve these goals, you will also be helping us to stay on the air and to continue to reach more people. So again, to subscribe to our study albums, sermons, or BEL videos, please go to our store at kgov.com or call us at 800-836-9278.